We'll call this meeting to order of the Greater Minnesota Jobs and Economic Development Finance Division. Welcome. I'm pinch hitting today. Vice Chair is having a bill up, and the chair is, I assume, stuck in traffic or bad weather back down home. So we will have a meeting today. Here's some financial presentations from the IRRRB, and folks, thank you for being down here today. And we will. I don't believe have enough for a quorum yet, so we'll do that when more folks come in. So with that, again, welcome everybody. And first up, we have an overview and presentation by Mr. Phillips. And welcome again today. Identify yourself, sir, and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Mark Phillips. I'm the commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Iron Range Resources and Rehabilitation. And I was asked today to just give a high-level overview of the agency, and then I think you're going to have somebody from the House Finance give you something on the finances. So you want to give the first slide. So our agency is 78 years old, formed in a regional economic development organization formed in 1941 by then Republican Governor Harold Stassen. And it was created as part of a legislative compromise about the proper level of mining taxation. So back in the 1920s and 30s, the mining industry in northeastern Minnesota paid ad valorem real estate taxes, like most normal commercial industrial real estate taxes. In addition to their facilities, they were taxed on unmined iron ore. And so when prior to the Great Depression, they were producing about 33 million tons and paying about 16 or 18 million a year in taxes. And then when that production slipped to about 3 million tons in 1932, they were still paying 18 million in taxes. And obviously, this was the first time, the Great Depression was the first time where they felt they were being taxed unfairly. So there was a legislative commission formed and a study, and there were ideas that were frankly developed by the Junior Chamber of Commerce on the Iron Range. They came back to the legislature, and eventually there was a compromise, and there was an agreement to tax minerals on a production basis rather than on unmined ore valuation. And that was really the start of it. And that legislation also, because there was, in 1932, there was probably 65% unemployment on the Iron Range, so they decided to, as part of that legislation, form an agency that would do economic and community development to try to develop the other resources that were available. And in the statute, it mentions that developing the remaining resources to include but not be limited to tourism. So tourism is the only specific thing mentioned in statute. The rest is go out and develop the remaining resources. Because we get asked once in a while why we're in the tourism business, so I thought I brought that up. next slide. Okay, so our headquarters is in Eveleth, Minnesota. We have a facility there. In fact, our facility is named after former Representative Joe Begich. Our service area, it's about 13,000 square miles, includes 50 cities, 132 townships, and encompasses 15 area school districts. It's a geography about the size of the state of West Virginia. The boundaries are shaped as they are because they use school district boundaries. So if a school district had mineral valuation or a processing facility or a power plant that served a processing facility, that whole school district was included. So if you look at some of the larger districts, particularly up in the tip of the Arrowhead, it's because there's a facility there and it takes in the whole school district. So the geography gets pretty large. There's three Iron Ranges involved. So if you see that little island down in Crow Wing County and Aiken County, that was the Cuyuna Iron Range. that finished mining in the mid-60s probably. And then you have the Mesaba Iron Range, basically Grand Rapids to Babbitt. And then you have the Vermilion Iron Range, which is up near Ely. So this is our statute 298.22. It gives the commissioner quite a bit of discretion. Much like other state agencies, the board appropriates and the commissioner implements. And so you can see that's where the language comes into developing the remaining resources. So the agency has developed a mission statement to promote and invest in business, community, and workforce development for the betterment of northeastern Minnesota. So these are the three legs of our stool: workforce, community development, economic development. I won't read these all the way through for you, but so we have value statements about our commitment and how we empower and encourage our employees, collaboration, and we strive towards equity and our intention that our partners, strategies, and investments reflect these values. So I mentioned the three legs of the stool. So our goal one is the regional economy is resilient and diversified. And we've been working on this for many years. The things that I've brought to the table since I've been there for 4 years, I served for Governor Dayton since 2015, was the trying to leverage our money. So in our economic development program, during the last 2 years, we've invested about $12.5 million in businesses, and the total project cost for those same projects is about $45 million. So we're leveraging our money with outside financing and private equity. Some examples of the economic development projects we've done: diversified economy. This is a project near the Hibbing Airport, Detroit Diesel Remanufacturing. They do remanufacturing for a number of customers, and mostly railroads and things like that. We have quite a customer care segment to our economy. Example shown in the photo is Blue Cross Blue Shield, Virginia and Aurora. They have two facilities. We also have Delta Airlines Reservation Center, Customer Care Center, and we have another group called Anthem, which is a spin-off of Delta Dental. So we have quite a complement of employees that work in this customer care segment in our region. So our second leg of our stool is the region's communities are stable, livable, and healthy. And one thing that, again, when I came to the agency, I looked at, did some research in areas of the country that have experienced successful economic turnarounds or diversifications or whatever measurement you want to use. And what really drove a lot of these successes were increasing the quality of life in that area, and that people, if it's an area people want to live, then historically then that's where the entrepreneurship takes place. So it's the desirability to live really drives a lot of the business development and the community development. So this is our goal. In the last 2 years, we've invested about $21 million in this area with our communities for public infrastructure and community facilities and things like that. Again, we focused on, you know, number one, job creation, the first goal. But secondly, we focused on leverage, where we can get the best bang for our public dollar. So the total project cost of that $21 million of our investment was about $254 million. So we've really leveraged our money, I think, wisely. Some of the programs that we've do that, we have development infrastructure program where we put infrastructure in if there's a project that's creates jobs and again leverages the money wisely. We do residential redevelopment, where we go in and take down tax forfeited properties. If there's a purpose for the land and we're going to increase the tax base, we help with the demolition side of that. We have a downtown program to try to resurrect some of our downtowns with streetscapes projects and things like that. We have for years and been involved in mine land reclamation, where we take dangerous, difficult situations and turn them into recreation and that kind of opportunities for our region. So some of our examples of this is that, you know, there's the state has an off-road vehicle park near Gilbert, Minnesota, and then we've done a lot of work in the mine land reclamation area that turns that into a recreation area. So there's an example in the photos. So the third leg of the stool is workforce developments, and so this is something that has really been on the forefront of our work in the last few years, particularly when it comes to higher education. So the agency works in partnership with the M-State campuses in our region called the Northeast Higher Education District, and we partner with them on programs. And we've offered, helped start a program called Iron Range Engineering, which is an applied engineering program where you can get a four-year degree without leaving the Iron Range. Your degree is conferred through Mankato, but you can take all your coursework and your co-op with a business. And it's actually an applied engineering program, one of the few in Minnesota. And, in fact, in the last year or so, we were recognized by MIT as one of the five best applied engineering programs in the world. So we're actually trying to leverage that into now offering a second program that might bring tuition dollars from outside the area that would support not only that program, but some of our other programs. We've also had some success in developing workforce programs that are driven by a local need. So we've, for example, we've had a lot of need for welders in our region locally, and there hasn't been a lot of success at M-State level in having successful long-term welding programs. So we've been trying to be more agile, and we offer a 10-week welding program that gets somebody enough skills to get hired into the industries that are applicable in our area. We have offered nursing programs in Grand Marais. We offer them for 1 to 3 years so they can get their complement of nurses back, but we cannot, these not a great enough need to have a program in perpetuity, but you can be flexible enough to offer it over a short term. We are also offering new curriculum through our workforce efforts. Because of demand for employees, we have a veterinary and technical program, a technician program in Ely recently that's been quite successful. So we're trying to be as agile as we can and offer the kind of training that people can find employment and are relatively short-term training kinds of programs.
Mr. Phillips, I had a question for you. You mentioned helping folks learn the welding skill, and that's a skill we need more of all over the state. And who do you work with, technical schools or the unions? Do they help out, too, with this type of training?
Yes. We have, they're offered at our technical colleges.
Okay.
So we have a number of technical college campuses in Grand Rapids, Hibbing, Eveleth, where primarily welding is offered there.
Okay.
And so we decided on this, not on our own, so we would have mini summit meetings with our industries that are looking for welders, and what we found is that most of them didn't require the level of a two-year degreed welder. Most of them needed entry-level welding skills that we can do in a 10-week course. So that's when we decided to offer these smaller courses.
Question from Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Good to see you.
Good to see you. It's entertaining for me to see the picture of the Tom Rukavina Engineering Center, and then the former representative in the middle of the picture there. With your 10-week welding course, where do those welders go? Where do they find employment?
They're finding employment at places like L&M Radiator in Hibbing, who just did a major expansion. They're a worldwide radiator manufacturer and remanufacturer, and they were hurting for welders. We also had a company called Joy Global, which was acquired by we had a local company called P&H Mine Pro. It was acquired by Joy Global. They were recently acquired by Komatsu, so they're an international company. And they are maintaining and remanufacturing mining equipment from all over the world in Virginia, Minnesota. So it's not just local equipment. It's brought in from elsewhere. And they were demanding more and more welders. If you drive by there, if you're going up north to International Falls or Ely or something like that, you drive right by Komatsu and you'll see the signs. And in addition to their sign Komatsu, right under it says welders needed. And there were some other local smaller fabrication shops and things like that. So we brought all the industry in, found out what level of welding they needed, and we need to offer a two-year program. I keep calling it MINSCU. M-State has struggled with two-year welding programs all over the state. So we knew that wasn't our answer. So we found out the level of skill needed, developed a curriculum, a 10-week curriculum, and it seems to be working right now.
Mr. Chair.
Representative, go ahead.
Where did these companies get their welders before this? I mean, the purpose of my question is to find out, over the last 20, 30 years, companies have been offloading their employee training programs onto the state. And that's a frustration, and, you know, okay, then we have more control over the workforce. So my question is, how much of this would have been done by the company itself versus on the taxpayer's dime?
Mr. Chairman,
I got to be careful over there, because This is IRRRB money. This is not state taxpayers. This is Iron Range property tax dollars.
Correct.
Mr. Chairman, sitting on my shoulder.
I'd be happy to. You know, I don't have all the answers, but I can tell you this much: we are seeing our industry in northeastern Minnesota has trained their workforce. So most of the mining companies, for most of my lifetime, have had apprenticeship programs. When we lost 25 or 30% of our population in the 1980s because of the refusal of the federal government from enforcing their trade laws, so we don't have as many workers to choose from anymore because we lost that much population, again, because of our government. And we were beginning to see it again here just a few years ago. And so, you know, it's a challenging environment when we have a healthy industry right now. It's cyclical, but we're short certain skills. So some of our mining companies, technical companies, are starting to bring back apprenticeship programs. So I don't think it's an unwillingness, but a small company like L&M Radiator or even Komatsu locally isn't huge. I don't know that they can afford to put in an apprenticeship program. They're going to cherry-pick skilled welders where they can find them. They advertise for them. They pay good wages, you know. But, again, we went from an industry that was pretty decent size and was artificially shrunk because of politics, I guess.
Mr. Chair, one last thing, and then I'll be done.
Representative Mahoney.
There are multitudes of academic studies that say that the companies that actually train their own workers or spend more on their training of early stage workers, they find those workers are much more productive and they tend to stay with the company longer. I'm sure, you know, Komatsu is looking and pays well and looking for good workers, but the next new thing will come in and steal those welders from them more likely than go out and train. So it's a vicious cycle. Mm-hmm. I'm happy to see the wages go up. It's about time. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I'm glad you're only doing a 10-week course because that doesn't cost as much as a one-year or two-year degree in welding, although it kind of limits where they can go. And just for the record, Mr. Chair, I did a two-year welding course and still couldn't do it well enough to get any respect out of my fellow members. But
Mr. Chairman, I would comment. I might have been remiss. Maybe I misspoke a little bit on this subject. So what we learned from the companies were that they were looking for entry-level welder skills that they would further develop around whatever they're doing. So I didn't want to leave the impression that these companies don't do any training once they hire these people. But they were looking for people with some basic skills, entry-level welding skills. And, in fact, you know, for years, the smaller companies, the vendors, struggled because the mining companies would take all the highest-skilled employees because they paid the best. Well, again, when we lost that 25 or 30% of our population, they also changed the work rules in our taconite mines, and most of the maintenance and things that were once provided by the companies themselves are now provided by outside vendors. Mm-hmm. And these are some of these same companies that I'm speaking of that are looking for skilled jobs. So,
Mr. Chair, and I'm sorry, it's not just the welders that these companies have offloaded onto government, and if we don't do it, other states will, so we have to do it. But I want everyone to realize that many of these companies, large and small, offload significant amounts of their workforce training onto the taxpayers. And unfortunately, we're getting stuck with the bill and add to their bottom line profit margin, which is called a subsidy of some sort or another. So it's a frustration of mine as the chair of the Jobs Committee that my budget keeps helping companies with their workforce in a way that they 20, 30 years ago, they did it all. They did it all. And now a significant chunk of the budget that I direct ends up doing a subsidy to large and small corporations. So.
Point well taken. Representative Salk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That line of discussion brings a question to my mind. Sometimes workforce training is done in order to bring somebody who is otherwise unemployed, possibly even unemployable, to a point where they have functioning skill levels that they can move into the workplace and possibly work through that workplace to increase their own stuff, as opposed to folks that are unemployed but are skilled and just have lost that place in the marketplace for their skills. Those are two different kinds of work that training does. I'm curious if you could tell me which this is more like.
Mr. Phillips.
Well, I would say it's a little of both in the sense that I would say it's people are underemployed. We try to get their skill levels up so they have some kind of career ladder, so they aren't stuck in a lower rung of the ladder, I guess, forever. Mm-hmm. So I spent a couple years at Deed being in charge of workforce for the state, and that has really been one of the goals. I mean, we used to call it Fast Track. They have a new name for it now, I think. Where you're trying to get people employed so they can take care of their families, but then at the same time have continuing education and everything so they can move up the job ladder. So we're seeing quite a bit of that.
Very good. Any further questions? Representative Salk.
One other question, and again, as a piece that you have, and I'm not experienced at all in understanding the workforce and the work structures up in the mining area. So when, I think I heard you right, is that the company that's rebuilding or remanufacturing older equipment, mm-hmm. and I have a picture of what I think, I grew up as a farmer, so I know the basics of what we're talking about, but maybe not the specific. But I got the impression that they take things that may be there, and then they also bring some things in from worldwide inventories that are out there that need to be brought back into service, and then are left there to be in service in the mining industry that exists. And I'm frankly just a little concerned about that, because that's one step away from being a dumping ground in my mind. And so if you can help me maybe understand it better, so that we're not the place where the world's obsolete equipment is coming to be made workable for a short period of time, but ends up being dumped in our for you guys to have to take care of.
No, I wouldn't want to leave that impression. What Komatsu does there is bring, it maintains locally used, and they do assembly too. When mining equipment is giant, so when it comes in pieces, so they do a lot of assembly of new equipment. But when they bring equipment from elsewhere, it gets remanufactured and sent back to where it came from or to a new location. They're not, nobody's dumping anything in northeastern Minnesota that I'm aware of.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Any further questions? If not, we have a quorum now. Would anybody care to peruse the minutes, Representative Lehman, and move to pass the minutes?
I'd be happy to do so, Mr. Chair.
Thanks, Representative. All those in favor of approving the minutes from the meeting of February 6th, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Minutes are approved. Carry on, Mr. Phillips.
Okay. So our fourth leg of our stool is the our goal for the agency to demonstrate management excellence. And so we use a continuous improvement process and evaluation and performance measurements. This is something that was started before my time. But we've continued that in evaluating the effectiveness of all our programs annually. And we also are very cognizant of the financial assets that we're given to manage, and the alternative solutions yield increased revenues and long-range capital costs are planned for. The other thing I just wanted to bring up is that one of our assets is the Giants Ridge Recreational Area nearby Wabik. Over a period of time since, I believe, the mid-1980s, it was acquired. There's been probably $45 million worth of investment on the part of the state in that recreational area, and there's been a little, almost $50 million worth of private investment made there. And we recently conducted a economic impact, and just on the very local area, or excuse me, the area codes are in the very tight circle around Giants Ridge, so by Wabik, Aurora, White Lakes, in that region, there's about a $43 million annual impact from that facility. So we are looking at ways to plan our future investments there to try to increase that number. We don't see any reason why we can't dramatically increase that annual economic impact if we're careful.
Mr. Phillips, just a quick question. Mm-hmm. I've been around here a while and always have kind of wondered about Giants Ridge.
Mm-hmm.
Is it state-owned, owned by the IRRRB, or what is the operation of that
facility? We own the public assets there. There's two championship golf courses, a ski area, ski and mountain bike trails, that kind of thing.
So when you say we, who are you referring to?
I'm sorry. Mr. Chairman, the agency, the IRRRB.
Okay.
But it's essentially a state asset.
Okay.
Because we're a state agency. But there's quite a bit of, so I mentioned there's about almost $50 million of private investment. There's hotels and condominiums and things like that, restaurants and stuff like that that are privately. Now, we managed this facility with state employees up to a couple of years ago, and we recently transitioned We had a lot of senior people that started back in 1984 when it was acquired by the state. So through some early retirement programs and everything, we transitioned into a management company, a company called Guest Services. They do a lot of management for the federal government at national parks and things like that. So right now we're having it privately managed under a contract with us. It's something we evaluate annually of how they're doing. We've made some inroads in reducing some of our labor expenses and things like that, but it's too early to tell if that trend can be maintained or accelerated or not. So it's something that we're going to look at every year as part of our strategic planning process.
I'd like to make it up there sometime. So. Mm-hmm. Continue.
So, taconite production taxes. I think you're going to have a little session on the agency, but you know, the state of Minnesota in the last 4 years has enjoyed some surpluses and increased revenues, and you have decisions to make on what to do with that. Well, the decisions we had to make, if you look at 14-15, that's when I was hired in 2015, and then you can see what happened to taconite production. So we had, over a two-year period, at one time we had four out of our five taconite plants shut down. One was shut down for 2 years. So we don't have the luxury to come to the legislature looking for a budget. Sometimes it's a benefit, but this time it was a curse because we're stuck with what the taconite revenues are. So we're just coming out of now. If you look forward in 19 and 20, and 20 will be our first fiscal year where we're starting to climb out of the hole. Taconite taxes are done on three-year averages, and it protects you if you have one bad year, like it did. I can't remember the year now, 2012, I think it was. There was one bad year, and it's just a blip because of the three-year average. But if you have two to three bad years, it becomes a trough, and it becomes quite long. So we've had to manage trying to keep our public programs because a lot of our communities rely on public works grants to leverage outside money, money from the PFA, money from the federal government through the rural development funding. And so we try to maintain our program. So we've leaned down. Our agency is, again, we contracted out the management at Giants Ridge to save money, where we've not replaced other employees. We had another early retirement and didn't replace everybody. So, our complement is down. This is an agency. At one time, I worked there in the Perpich years when we had 120 employees. We have 44 employees now. So, and that's through a series of things. I won't take credit for all this. We used to staff and manage the what was called Iron World at one time, called the Minnesota Discovery Center, turned it over to a nonprofit. We did these things at Giants Ridge. We used to have a highway rest area and just south of Eveleth. We operated a couple of area over in the West Range that is now a state park, the Hill Annex State Park. We used to operate that. So over a period of years, we've got the agency down to try to do the things that we think we can move the needle a little bit on. So we think the areas that we've landed on, doing business development, community development, and workforce development, are the things that we can have an impact. So the distribution of those tax dollars. So because these taxes are paid in lieu of property taxes, the majority goes to where everybody else's property taxes go. They go to your local cities, counties, school districts, just like everybody else. But because these taxes are legislated, not levied against a budget, there are residuals. So if you look at this, once you pay out the formulas to those people that usually get the property tax dollars, the agency, Iron Range Resources and Rehabilitation, get the residuals to do this economic development. There's also a program in statute that allows the mining companies to get a rebate on their tax, a small portion of their taxes, if they reinvest in their plants to make the plants last longer or increase production. You'll see that in the chart, pie chart. And there's also a property tax relief account for local residents that live in very poor property wealth areas.
Representative Salk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, I'm extraordinarily naive. Let's just assume that right now. So tell me or give me some sort of a model as to what the conduits of revenue are for the IRRRB and how do they interrelate to the way most of us think of property taxes relative to our county, townships, school districts, because I'm seeing mixed ownership of those conduits of revenue. So if you can make that simpler for this farm kid.
Sure.
Mr. Phillips.
I hope I can. Mr. Chairman, I hope I can make it simple enough. So the makeup of your property taxes in your region, you have residential property taxpayers and you have commercial industrial property taxpayers. So the state of Minnesota gave the mining industry a different way to pay property taxes. So just one industry. The thing is, it's a huge portion of our commercial industrial property tax base up there. And they pay it in a different way. They pay it on production.
Yep.
And so the state set up, in statute, formulas so that money goes to where it's supposed to. But again, in your situation, in your hometown, the property tax base, whether residential or commercial, is levied against your different units of government, put together a budget, and then they figure out a mill rate and they levy against those assets. Because these are legislated, the formulas fill up, I call them buckets, they fill up all the buckets for the city, the township, the school district, and the county, and then the residuals spill into the IRRRB for these programs. And it was designed that way. So when these little tiny communities have bigger infrastructure projects that don't happen every year, it's not part of their ongoing deferred maintenance or their operating budgets, they have a place to go to do a bigger infrastructure project. So we have a public works grant program every year. It's been as high in history as $12-15 million a year. During my time, when we were in the tough times, it was $4-6 million a year down in the pits of the time. So again, what we decided to do is to say we're going to do the projects that lever the most outside money, or have an environmental emergency, or we had some certain criteria that we base all our grant programs are scored based on competitive criteria. And from program to program, they vary. Some we have energy efficient programs that based on how much energy you can save. But our public works are primarily leverage, job creation, and increasing the quality of life.
Representative Salk.
Thank you. So just make sure I didn't forget what my line of thought was. So essentially, you characterize it as tough times. I understand what that would be. That is measured against your running balance over time or your average balance over time that would typically be available for these single requests or operational needs in smaller increments. But that balance is kind of your measure of whether you've been in really bad times or good times. Mm-hmm. And it gets down. Have you ever had the time when it sort of hit zero or those kinds of levels? Or is it just that you're getting lower and you can move less into other projects, but you have to measure keeping a certain balance on hand?
Mr. Chairman, we budget... How you say it? We only spend, unlike the legislature, where you're looking out at an estimate, we don't spend any of our money until we actually have it.
Yep.
So there's not a danger of us running out.
Right.
So we would cut. So we're one cycle behind where the state's one cycle ahead.
And just, Mr. Chair, one little. So the conduit of revenue is singular. It's the... production tax.
Mr. Chairman, That's correct,
Commissioner Phillips.
Yeah. Thank you. Taconite production tax, no other source.
Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good to see you again.
Good to see you.
When and if copper nickel mining is going to start, how are we going to get money by the ton for the IRRRB, or how are we going to get money to take care of the property taxes from the things that we're taking out of the ground that can't put be shoved back in there? How are we going to get? How are we going to do it with something that could have more value than all the oil and coal in North Dakota? You know, how are we going to assess that?
Commissioner Phillips.
Mr. Chairman, I'm counting on people like you in the legislature to figure that out. Right now, what is being proposed for copper nickel is some kind of net proceeds tax, and I don't believe there's plans on the books yet to filter any of those revenues to Iron Range Resources, but I would anticipate that people will have ideas if the copper mining takes off.
Representative Gunther.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and certainly I remember past investments that you made, like chopstick factories and stuff like that. I assume that your track record since you've been there has greatly improved, because I know you've cut the cost substantially. Do you think that if we give you substantially more money that you could make up for some of those years that we probably haven't had enough economic development to take care of the purpose of that?
Commissioner Phillips.
Yes. Mr. Chairman, I should say that because I was around when the chopstick factory was proposed too, so I left for 25 years and then came back. But so there have been challenges from time to time, but you know, I was a banker as well for part of my career, and one thing you learn in banking school is there's never a bad loan the day you make it. Some turn bad later on, but we are being extremely conservative and careful. In fact, most of the development we're trying to attain right now are with pretty well-heeled companies. We have a proposal that came to the legislature for help with a company called Louisiana Pacific, who has manufacturing operations in our region, and they're proposing to build a quite sizable plant. And they're a publicly traded company, and we think they're some of the kinds of things that we should be doing. They're using our natural resources. They geographically make sense for our region. Sometimes I think in the past we've tried to force something that didn't make a lot of sense maybe in our region or something like that. But so we're sticking to our dealing with our natural resources, including our people. We have a great customer care industry, because we have really great schools, we have highly educated people, we have low turnover because there's not as many operations. Well, I had a question over here earlier about, you train somebody and then they just go somewhere else. Well, there's not as many opportunities in rural areas, not just northern Minnesota, but all over rural Minnesota. So when you create a good paying job, they can't really drive across town like they can in the metro and find the same employment somewhere else for an extra quarter an hour or something like that. So when we train people, especially in our customer care section, they've had experienced low turnover, which the employers really like. And if they're good employers, people stick around.
Representative Selk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So he just sparked a whole other set of another question in my mind, and I'd like a little more substance in the answer if we can get it, and that is the new mining system structure, the proposed copper nickel whole thing, will that drop into being a similar asset for the conduit of revenue as the mines did?
Mr. Chairman, as presently under present law, it would not be. But I would anticipate the legislature would take a hard look at that, because it's a non-renewable resource. Usually putting some of that back in the local economy would make some sense, I would think. But I think that the legislature didn't get ahead of themselves. They wanted to see if there's going to be some development before we establish all kinds of laws on how we might spend the money.
Representative,
you've just traipsed on my concern, and it's not, it's mostly the issue that the state should be responsibly planning how they're going to bring the copper nickel mining. I don't know how best to say what the word I'd be comfortable with is adventure. How that will, I mean, so they're running out business plans without any technical assignment of how they will fit into the Minnesota economy relative to the rest of the mining structure up in the mining area and all of that. So, I mean, you know, give me a name of one of the companies. They all expected to have to pay that production tax in their business plans. So we've got this other group now coming into the state with no expectation of how they're going to have to contribute to the well-being of the people in that area?
Mr. Chairman?
Commissioner Phillips.
I'm running the great risk of being out of my area of expertise, but I believe, if I'll tell you what the way I understand it, there is a tax structure for non-ferrous mining, and it's called a net proceeds tax. You ought to get somebody from revenue over to explain that to you, but it's essentially like a corporate income tax of some kind based on net proceeds. But I think we'd be naive to think that at some point in time that those net proceeds would filter their way back into the local economy, whether it's through the IRRRB or through some other mechanism more directly to the cities or the townships or the county or something, school districts. So they're commercial industrial property taxes. I would think they would filter back eventually.
I appreciate your answer. I understand it, I think, and I'm not – it makes me less happy to understand your answer, but I think it is the truthful and the reality of the circumstance. I'm not impressed nor enamored that we have such a significant entity, business entity in operation, moving into this area of the state with the state not having performed and laid out what their expectation of their participation in the state would include. And I think the fact that you've sort of made a passing reference to another tax method or those kinds of things, I understand that that's all there. I'm just a little disappointed, I guess, that we don't have a better, more firm grasp on the ideas that might, and it would, I guess, fall to all of us that why haven't we started to conceptualize this? There, I know that we don't want to scare somebody off by saying you're going to be taxed, but I go with what you're saying is anybody of sound mind who's going to run a business of that structure in this area, any area of the state, probably thinks there's going to be a commensurate tax structure that they're going to have to participate in how the area is going to continue to have the vitality and the ability to support its people.
Commissioner Phillips.
Yeah, well, I'm getting out of my area
of expertise. Please don't feel like you have to go down the road farther than you're comfortable with. I'm laying traps all over the place. So,
Mr. Chairman, Representative, so there are other minerals. So we recently worked with the Natural Resource Research Institute, which is part of the University of Minnesota Duluth, looking at a technology that could take the levels of ilmenite resources in Minnesota are quite significant, but there hadn't been a technology to actually beneficiate that to the degree it could be used before now, but now there was a Canadian technology that, so we spent some money and the university spent some money and found out that it looks like it could be economical. So the next phase will be is somebody that probably has access, owns some of those mineral rights, would have to find a corporation that would want to come in and exploit those. I don't think the first thing they look at is what's the tax structure in Minnesota, but they will. I agree with you. I guess I'm tending to agree with you. Eventually that has to come. But we haven't seen anything permitted in a long time So I think that people are kind of waiting to see how the environmental permitting goes on some of these things. And one thing about ilmenite, it's in low sulfate ground. It should be easier to exploit without all the environmental concerns, so I'm hoping that that's going to be a better thing. But so any kind of commercial industrial property taxes finds their way back to the city, county, township, school district. If it's ad valorem, if they're paying their taxes that way,
yep,
it's going to find its way back. I'm saying taconite comes back through a production tax, and some of that comes to the agency. Whether that's going to be the method ultimately that the non-ferrous will use or not, I don't know. Well, time will tell.
Thank you.
I don't see any other questions.
I only have a couple more slides, I think. So this is just and these are in those little booklets you have, so I don't want to go over these numbers and things, but to give you a rough idea what our development, our operations, and our projects and our pass-through money, what it looks like from year to year. This is our projection for 20 and 21. Again, it's in your booklet. So again, I talked a little bit earlier about our complement of employees, where it was and where it's come down to. And again, some of this has been through contracting out some of our management and things like that, but I think it's efficiency. So there's our website. So a lot of the questions that you might think of later, you might just want to click on there. We have a lot of information on there. And my phone number is on here and my email address, and I'd be happy to spend time individually with anybody. I was reappointed by Governor Walz. I worked for 6 years for Governor Dayton, 2 years at Deed, and 4 years at IRRRB. So I've been around state government quite a while, and again, back in the 80s, I worked in the Purpich administration for 5.5 years, almost 6 years. I've seen some of the projects that have been most notorious, but I think one thing I would point out is there's been a lot of good work done by the agency that doesn't get a lot of publicity. It's just whenever something doesn't go perfectly that you get a lot of press. But I think you'd find if you spent some time with us that, you know, we do an awful lot of good work.
Representative Lehman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I can't let this meeting go by without saying something about the agency. I served for 8 years in the Planning Administration as commissioner, and Representative Gunther and I were just agreeing that you have an easier job than I had. A little different environment. But my question is this, and this is the question that faces every commissioner, and I think it would just be helpful because this is the only agenda item we have. We seem to have some time for discussion, just for all of us to be informed about natural resources and northeastern Minnesota. Is you talked about the mission of the agency from way back in this Governor Stassen days was to develop the remaining resources, which leads one to believe not the natural resources, but the other resources. And yet, the resources are what makes the area rich, the mineral resources, the timber resources, and the future seems to be in adding value to those resources. You know, what is the next wood products? What's the next mining venture? What can NRI develop that can help us, that's environmentally friendly and can create jobs and so on? So I guess it would just be helpful to hear from you, Commissioner Phillips, how do you balance how much attention you spend and pay to developing those resources, the value added, which oftentimes is totally out of our control. We have ESSER now in the news coming and going, and these, you know, international interests that have financial ties around the globe that we can't even trace sometimes. But how do you balance the attention paid to those really high-paying good jobs that come from the natural resources and developing that to the welding jobs and the remaining resources, the diversification piece?
Commissioner Phillips.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to comment on that because that's real interesting because I think every commissioner has a different interpretation of what that developing the remaining resources means. And I think we've been fairly consistent in not, we haven't put a lot of agency program money into iron ore mining, for example, because that's the resource that we're already getting our revenues from. So we don't put back. In fact, when ESSER decided not to build the steel mill and was just going to build the taconite plant, we lost interest because we didn't need any more taconite plants at that time. We needed a steel mill, value added. So I think your interpretation where we try to put, if we're going to do anything in mining, it would be around adding value because that would be developing the remaining resources. Some could say non-ferrous is. Like I said, we put a small investment along with the university and the ilmenite thing. We promote Minnesota's minerals at the annual Prospector and Developers Conference in Toronto every year in partnership with the Natural Resource Research Institute, Minnesota DNR, Minnesota Geological Survey, and ourselves together try to promote Minnesota's minerals, which includes, by the way, aggregate, too, gravel, sand, you name it. So minerals in Minnesota is not just iron ore. It's a lot of things. And so we're promoting Minnesota's minerals. But the other resources, we do invest in tourism. We do invest in technology where we can. But it's... Every once in a while, if you have a local entrepreneur like you see with DigiKey up in Thief River or something like that, and lightning strikes, it just doesn't strike very often. So I try not to be delusional to think that you can just, if you could just take money and attract a whole bunch of industry, we would have already done it because we've thrown a lot of money at a lot of projects. So I think over time, and again, since 1941, we're gradually figuring this out, that we got to go where people, where they need our resources in some way, whether it's people, geography, transportation things. You know, we have a rail that goes right from Canada right by us. So when I was at Deed, we had the phenomena, if you order something that needed to be delivered by rail in International Falls, if it came from Canada, it would ride right by you, and it would go to Chicago, get put on a truck, and driven back to International Falls. So I was the deed commissioner. I thought, this does not make a lot of sense to me. So we put a railroad siding for $500,000 in International Falls so that Boise Cascade Paper could unload something in International Falls. Didn't seem like it was rocket science, but that had an economic impact for International Falls. There's things like that that I think we have a great port in Duluth. We have all kinds of advantages of moving goods and things up in our region. We have minerals. We have forest products. We're undercutting our, in fact, we're at danger of disease and fire with our forests because we're not taking enough allowable cut anymore. Because we had paper mills who have shut down machines all over in Grand Rapids, International Falls, everywhere. We lost all our board plants in northeastern Minnesota and Cook and Grand Rapids and Bemidji. So there's lots of opportunities for forest products that we're targeting that, biochemistry using cellulosic methods so you can chip trees up and make chemicals from them. I think that's an opportunity for our area. It's where the prairie meets the forest. There's all kinds of cellulosic product to be converted. So there's... I'm excited about where rural Minnesota could go if we play our cards right.
Okay. Thank you, Commissioner. Mm-hmm. Members, I do just want to let you all know we've got about a half hour left. We do still have to hear from our House nonpartisan fiscal staff, so just to be mindful of that. But Representative Sandstead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Phillips, thank you for that presentation, that overview. Early on, when just at the beginning of it, you made the comment that the board appropriates and the commissioner implements when it comes to the budget. Maybe just tell the committee a little bit more about the 2017 legislative changes and that there's been a change there.
Commissioner Phillips.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Sansett, thank you. I probably should have pointed that out. So from 1941 till about 1995, the legislation, IRRB legislation, was like a lot of other statutes in Minnesota. It talks about the commissioner shall, the commissioner will do this and that with the resources. And so the board was more advisory on most things up until 95. And for whatever reason, the legislature relooked at that and gave the board 100% authority over most of the funds. And the commissioner was bound by what the board wanted to do. And they had to have certain number of votes. They had to have super majorities on certain things. It was quite complex. We had a legislative audit in 2015 that was mostly around compliance issues. As an addendum to that audit, it wasn't part of the audit reflection on the agency's operation, but as an addendum, they wrote a piece that said that there were some constitutional issues about the board having that much power, them being legislators and then also having that power. So Representative Lehman, and I can't remember who carried it in the Senate, but there was a bill that was passed.
Senator Bach.
That brought that board oversight and advisory nature, brought it back to the table, so to speak, in every area except for two things. And that's why I said the board appropriates, because the two things that the board does have power over the commissioner, I propose a budget, they approve that. It's a real approval process. And the governor has to also approve it. So that's the kind of the oversight, is the board and the governor on the budget and on selling any real estate assets. So before we could dispose of Giants Ridge or, I guess, Minnesota Discovery Center or something, other real estate we might own, we'd have to have the board's approval to do that. So most of the time, our resolutions read at our board meetings that the board approves a resolution that says we are advising the commissioner to do whatever the action is. So if it's a grant to a community, they are advising me. And it rarely comes up, but when it does, somebody said, well, Deasy, it sounds like the board's approving this. They're advising, and I would say I was around during those early years before it changed in 1995, so I worked in the 80s, and the commissioners rarely ever went against what the board's advice was. I mean, you'd have to have a pretty good reason, I'd say, when you have, in those years, it was 11 members, you have 11-0 vote on something, and then you're going to do just the opposite. You'd have to have a pretty good reason, because I think you would be called to task in the media and by the public if you... Now, it is a fail-safe, though. If something was attempted that the commissioner felt was inappropriate, you do have some veto power, I guess you'd call it. But that's my explanation of that. I hope that answers your questions.
All right. I don't see we have any other questions here. I appreciate you coming into the committee, Commissioner, very much. Thank you. And next up, members, we do have Solveig Beckel with nonpartisan fiscal staff to give us an overview on funding of the Department of Iron Range Resources and Rehabilitation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, representatives.
Thank you, Ms. Beckel.
My name is Solveig Beckel, and I'm with the House Fiscal Staff. I have three documents that should be in your packet, so if you would just check briefly to see if you have the 2018 Distribution of Production Tax sheet. A sheet that looks like this. It's got the Iron Range Resources and Rehabilitation Fund, as well as the Douglas J. Johnson Fund. And then just a spreadsheet I've put together with basic expenditures and appropriations. So, Chair Pawlowski asked me to provide a brief overview of how the IRRRB is funded and how they use their funds. Commissioner Phillips did a fantastic job, of course, explaining the latter and probably the former, but I'm going to go over the former again. I will try to keep this brief. As Commissioner Phillips mentioned, the IRRRB has been funded primarily through production taxes since its creation in 1941. They're paid in lieu of property taxes on the mining and production of taconite, direct reduced iron, and iron-bearing materials, and these taxes are written into Minnesota Statute Section 298. The production tax rate is indexed annually based on changes in the gross domestic product implicit price deflator, which is published by the U.S. Department of Commerce. So that will change over time. For example, the 2013 production tax rate was $2.56, where the 2018 production tax rate was $2.751 per taxable ton. So let's quickly take a look at this document, the 2018 distribution of production tax. You can see the breakdown of where the tax revenues go. This just supports what Commissioner Phillips was saying. CPT on this sheet represents cents per taxable ton, and you can see that the IRRRB is just one section on this sheet, the circled portion. If you flip this sheet over, you can see the distribution of all mining taxes, and I believe someone had a question about the net proceeds tax. That is listed on this side of the sheet, and they do talk about how this would be similar to the production tax. Of course, no minerals subject to this tax are currently mined. Okay, I'm going to switch over to the consolidated funds now. So the IRB oversees a number of funds, and the three ones that show up in the state budget are the IRRRB Fund, the Douglas J. Johnson Economic Protection Trust Fund, and the Giants Ridge Golf and Ski Resort Fund. You can see a breakdown of the first two in this document, expenses, revenues, etc. And you can also see them in this document, as well as the Giants Ridge Golf and Ski Resort. The first two are special revenue funds, and the third is an enterprise fund. So, as I mentioned earlier, the IRRRB is funded overwhelmingly by those production taxes. There is a tiny statute that sort of essentially makes the state of Minnesota like a mining company and says that it has to pay 22 cents per taxable ton in a year. So you'll see that referenced on the breakdown sheet I've provided you, a little note at the bottom. So there is that money that does come from the state, but sort of originally from the Iron Range. And then there is in statute, in the statute section 298.17, two different things that show up at the top of this sheet. You will see the general fund transfer in those values. That refers to items in the statute saying that 1.5 cents per taxable ton is for like loan programs or grant programs, essentially, and 6% per taxable ton is for the basically schools. And you can see that on this sheet. That is all I have to say, but I would welcome any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Beckel. Questions from members? All right. Seeing none, going once, twice, sold. I believe we are adjourned. Thank you.